Coming up is the news.
China has called on Washington to emphasize on diplomacy rather than pressure in its policy towards North Korea. Egypt signs a contract to purchase 30 fighter jets from France. Human Rights Watch warns the deal would only encourage the ruthless repression by Cairo. Also coming up, Israeli forces attack and injure 10 Palestinians protesting against the expulsion of some inhabitants of Sheikh Jarrah district of occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: China has called on Washington to emphasize on diplomacy rather than pressure in its policy towards North Korea. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests. Now, China's UN ambassador says he hopes the US will emphasize dialogue instead of pressure tactics in its reviewed policy on North Korea. The diplomat's remark follows US Secretary of State Antony Blinken's statement that Pyongyang needs to decide whether it wants to engage diplomatically regarding the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's a day after North Korea lashed out at the US in a series of statements, saying Washington's recent policies are proof of a hostile strategy that requires a corresponding response. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense amid the U.S. military's provocations. U.S. President Joe Biden, in his address to Congress, had said that North Korea's nuclear program poses a serious threat that would be addressed through diplomacy and stern deterrence. Joining us is Ian Williams, a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, and also Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Gentlemen, welcome. Ian, you know, Biden said that Pyongyang needs to decide whether it wants to engage diplomatically. Why not try the opposite, if you catch my drift? As in, North Korea doesn't have its military forces on America's borders, nor does it engage in war games on America's borders?
No, but there's a whole series of broken promises and failed signals on both sides here. I mean, the agreements have been very delicately negotiated with a lot of ambiguity and shuffle room, which is the only way they could get past. And each side has encroached upon these consistently. There are no angels here. I mean, the Chinese would very much like the North Koreans to stop all of this because it messes up their patch as well. But on the other hand, they're tied with historical obligations, in a sense. Huge casualty rate during the Korean War, in which the Americans, you know, were threatening to use nuclear weapons on mainland China. And then on the other side, you have American pledges to South Korea, which they're bound to, not just for the South Koreans' sake, but it ruins the whole chain of other events. If they don't stick by the South Koreans, then Japanese, Taiwan, lots of other places are going to say, well, if they're not going to look after the South Koreans, they're not going to look after us as well. So there's a whole chain of obligations, and that's dangerous, because you remember, this is how World War One started. It was that chain of overlapping treaty obligations and gestures.
Right.
And, you know, the North Koreans are not exactly the most lucid and transparent negotiating partners. They have a tendency to agree, take whatever they can get, and then ask more afterwards.
So
the previous agreement was working until Clinton and co. ripped it up some years ago.
Right. Richard, how can this situation be resolved when North Korea says that its nuclear weapons are you know, a deterrent, a strong deterrent to survival.
Well, I think that we have to remember that in the last administration, we had John Bolton. Bolton and Pompeo accompanied Trump to Vietnam for negotiations around which there were quite high hopes, or at least that appeared to be the case. But we have to remember that John Bolton's policy, when asked about North Korea years ago, replied, our policy is no North Korea. In other words, it has to be wiped out. I think that's, now we're into a new administration, the Biden administration. Are we going to see anything different? I think that's the question. We should remember also that the Vietnam talks ended very abruptly. And according to some reports, and I think quite credible reports, the reason that they ended was that the United States, Trump, gave a piece of paper to Kim Jong-un, and the piece of paper said that, and it was reportedly in both Korean and in English, that North Korea should turn over all of its nuclear weapons and nuclear material to the United States. And that brought an abrupt end to that meeting, and unexpectedly abrupt end.
Right.
People were all gathered together anticipating that there was going to be a different kind of announcement altogether, one that would lead toward a lessening of the
Richard, keep that thought for just keep that thought for just a second. Ian, if I could just get back to you, how much can the lifting of sanctions play a role in resolving this decades-old, you know, dispute?
Well, look, certainly the North Koreans would welcome the lifting of sanctions. And remember, in the whole case of sanctions, the sanctions are against a population which has no political influence whatsoever on Pyongyang's decisions. So they're completely unjustifiable. You know, there's a justification, say South African sanctions or even sanctions against Israel because there's an electric you can influence and say there's a penalty for choosing your government. It's a long time since North Koreans had a say in who was ruling in the Workers' Party in Pyongyang. So the sanctions are really criminal because they're penalizing an innocent population to try to achieve the only point of sanctions is to force the people to put pressure on their government. There's no way that the North Koreans can put pressure on their government short of major insurrection.
And
so the sanctions are on that level. They're so broad-based that they are probably a humanitarian crime. There are targeted sanctions which you can put on, but there's a vindictiveness about them. I mean, these sanctions regimes, as we saw with Iraq, they get a life of their own. They carry on forever, long past their effectiveness. And they extend beyond the immediate purposes.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your time. Let's thank our guests for their contribution. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Ian Williams, senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, joining us from New York, and also Richard Becker at the from the Answer Coalition, joining us out of San Francisco. Moving on now, France has signed a contract to sell 30 Rafale fighter jets to Egypt in a $4.5 billion deal. It was announced by Egypt's defense ministry. President Emmanuel Macron said in December he would not make the sale of weapons to Egypt conditional on human rights. He noted that he did not want to weaken what he called Cairo's ability to counter terrorism in the region. Macron's comment, however, has been denounced, including by Human Rights Watch. The HRW director for France said that Paris, with such a deal with Cairo, is only encouraging the repression carried out by the government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Political commentator Sami Hamdi says France's arms sale to Egypt is a green light for President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to embark on his crackdown on human rights.
I don't think Sisi needs a green light from France to essentially embark on his crackdown on human rights. I think from 2013, when the world did nothing following his military coup on the democratically elected Mohamed Morsi, who is now deceased, I think the international community's willingness to recognize Sisi and willingness to recognize an election in which he won, between quotation marks, 96 percent of the vote, and then won another election, which he didn't really run against any credible candidate. I think the international community's willingness to recognize that for the sake of what they call stability and security in the region, and Sisi's willingness to engage in ensuring interests that the international community believe are conducive to the global order that they wish to underpin, whether that's the protection of Israel, whether that's the repressing of let's call it the Islamic identity, insofar as there was panic at the rise of Islamist parties who dominated the elections. So I think that with regards to this particular deal, I think it doesn't necessarily give a green light, but it essentially affirms the continuation of permission for Sisi to continue doing as he wishes.
People have staged a rally in the commune of Saint-Briac in northwestern France to protest against an offshore wind farm project. The protesters, who are mostly fishermen and members of the environmental associations, say the project is harmful to the region's ecology. They also say that drilling on the seabed will kill all the fish there. French officials, however, maintain that the impact of the wind farm project would be limited on the environment. They have also given assurances that fishing will be allowed within the wind farm. The project will see 62 wind turbines installed some 16 kilometers off the nearest coast. Journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked World Press Freedom Day. The international occasion is very important for Palestinian journalists, who often get attacked by Israeli soldiers in a clear violation of their right to cover the news. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests, almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinian protesters in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, injuring at least 10 of them. The regime's forces attacked the Palestinians holding a sit-in protest in Sheikh Jarrah district against the expulsion of some inhabitants there. They also detained some protesters. An Israeli court on Sunday ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes until Saturday, despite having lived there for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the geographic character of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Iraqi authorities say at least four rockets have hit a military airbase hosting U.S. forces north of the capital, Baghdad. Iraqi security officials said the rockets hit near the base where American contractors were billeted. No casualties have been reported so far. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack as well. On Sunday, two rockets targeted an airbase at Baghdad International Airport, housing U.S.-led coalition troops. Attacks on U.S. troops and their supply convoys in Iraq have increased recently amid growing anti-American sentiment there. The anti-U.S. anger grew after Washington assassinated the top Iranian general and the senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January last year. American civil rights activist Al Sharpton has called for an end to racism in the country, urging lawmakers to take action to stop racial profiling.
This must stop. Enough is enough. How many funerals do we have to have before we tell the Congress and the Senate that you've got to do something in these times?
Sharpton was addressing people taking part in a funeral ceremony for Andrew Brown, an African-American killed by police. Sharpton called on law enforcement officials to release the whole tape of the police encounter with Brown. 42-year-old Brown was fatally shot during a morning raid at his home on April 21st when local sheriff's deputies tried to serve him with search and arrest warrants. His killing in mysterious circumstances has captured national attention. The United States has been the scene of mass anti-racism protests following the death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a white officer last year. 5 days of violent protests against a proposed tax reform bill in Colombia have left at least 19 people dead and over 800 injured. The Ombudsman's office said 16 of civilians and one police officer died during the nationwide protests that broke out April 28th. The unrest forced the government of President Ivan Duque to withdraw the proposal on Monday. Duque had earlier said tax rises were necessary to respond to the economic crisis brought on by COVID-19. But the bill caused outrage among many Colombians who say they are already struggling to feed their families during the pandemic. Colombia's gross domestic product saw its sharpest crash in half a century, with the pandemic driving up unemployment rates. Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
Arizona is taking center stage in the relentless effort to rein in voter participation in the name of election security, advancing the first in a batch of bills aimed at making votes by mail harder, says Marianne K. Schneider, writer, in an article titled Arizona is on verge of adopting voter suppression laws. Stay tuned, please, for the details. Arizona is taking center stage in the relentless effort to rein in voter participation in the name of election security, advancing the first in a batch of bills aimed at making votes by mail harder. These Republican-led efforts are based on the issue that the 2020 presidential election was stolen and mail-in voting is insecure. Arizonans are extremely concerned that proposed changes to the permanent early voting list, also known as PEVL, would disrupt long-standing practices that encourage voting. The list is widely popular in the state. It makes voting much easier because voters on the list automatically receive their ballot in the mail without having to affirmatively request it. About 3.2 million voters are on the list right now, and voters of all political stripes are almost equally presented. The list currently consists of 36% Republicans, 35% Democrats, and 29% unaffiliated voters or those registered with other parties. At the same time as attacks on mail-in voting are moving through the legislature, the Arizona Senate is engaged in an unprecedented legislative audit of the ballots of a single county, Maricopa, in a quest to discover irregularities in those ballots. The Senate is proceeding with the audit, even though Maricopa County already conducted its own audit of ballots and a forensic audit of voting machines, and both confirmed the outcome of the 2020 election. This audit could also be used as an excuse for passing bills that restrict access to voting. In fact, a Republican senator has announced she is holding up all voting bills, positive or negative, until the results of the audit are reported, because she is convinced the review of Maricopa ballots will reveal issues that need a legislative remedy. But it's only a temporary reprieve, because as long as the legislature remains in session, anti-democratic bills can be brought to a floor vote, passed, and head over to the governor. One of them is SB 1485, which the Arizona has passed recently, failed in the Senate, and is currently under a motion for reconsideration. It would require counties to purge from the early voting list voters who did not vote an early voting ballot in both the primary and general election in two consecutive election cycles. Even if they voted in person in every election during the four-year period, they would still be removed from the early voting list because they didn't use their early ballot. Removing voters from the permanent early voting list makes it more likely that those people will not participate in elections. Increasing opportunities for mailing voting brings marginal voters in elections and retains voters who might otherwise choose not to participate. Current estimates predict that 125,000 to 150,000 voters will be jettisoned from the early voting list if this bill is signed into law. If it had been enacted in 2019, approximately 126,000 Arizonans who voted in 2020 would have been removed. A voter who does not receive their mail ballot will have to vote in person, which can be difficult for some people, especially those living on remote tribal lands. The predicted number of voters who risk removal are well above the margins of victory in both the 2018 and 2020 statewide federal elections. Unfortunately, SB 1485 is just one in a series of bills introduced this year that aim to limit access to mail voting. SB 1713 would require voters to include their date of birth and one of two acceptable ID numbers when they return their early ballot, an Arizona driver license number or voter registration number. By excluding other types of ID, the state is closing the door on many voters who do not have these numbers. Moreover, the universe of voters who do not have a driver's license disproportionately consists of voters of color and older voters. While the bill allows voters to use their voter registration number on their return envelope, most voters do not have that number readily available. This bill would force voters to jump through additional hoops to send back their early ballot. So importantly, failure to include this additional information gives election officials a reason to toss out those ballots. Several other restrictive bills would make it harder for voters to fix or cure a mail ballot that has problems, and they threaten criminal penalties for both election officials and citizens for trying to encourage mail voting. SB 1003 would limit the time for curing a missing signature on a mail-in ballot to 7 p.m. on election day. The cure period for mismatched signature and other missing information is longer. Voters who have until the fifth business day after the election to do so. HB 2792 would make it a felony for an election official to send a voter an early ballot unless the voter requests it. SB 1106 would, among other things, subject any person to criminal liability for knowingly assisting another person that resides in another state in voting, including by forwarding an early ballot to that person. The board contenders of the bill could encompass seemingly begin action, like a parent sending a mail ballot to their child away at college in another state. All of these bills have already been passed by one chamber of the legislature and have been passed out of committee by the other, so they stand a real chance of heading to the governor's desk soon. Compounding these attempts to limit voter participation, the legislature had already tied the hands of local election officials by enacting a new law that prohibits the state and local election officials from receiving or spending private monies in the administration of elections. This legislation, like others around the U.S., is a backlash against the philanthropic grants to help election officials to cope with the increased cost of running the 2020 election amid a pandemic. True to form, Arizona did not attempt to remedy the shortfall with additional tax dollars. As the state legislatures perpetuate the myth that mail voting is insecure, it's vitally important to call out these blatantly undemocratic efforts to prevent certain people from voting. Grassroots organizations in Arizona deserve enormous credit for beating back the worst bills in Arizona during this session. While the Arizona legislative audit and its attendant political gamesmanship plays out, it's still necessary to guard against dangerous attacks on mail-in voting that could result in disenfranchising tens of thousands of voters. The nationwide dislike of voter suppression measures has left little doubt. Americans, from everyday people to high-ranking corporate executives, understand that laws seeking to deter participation constitute an unacceptable attack on democracy. It's well past time for state legislators to stop these efforts. We'll be right back.
WRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Suhail Sarani. Brother Suhail, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. So for today's discussion, we are discussing the important topic of the book Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sharif al-Radhi, or known as Sayyid al-Radhi. He was the one who collected and selected the most important sermons, or speeches, letters, and aphorisms or wise sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the book Nahjul Balagha. This book is considered as one of the greatest books in Islam after the Holy Quran, and unfortunately it's a pity that it's not given that much due attention even inside Islam, but there have been so many different interpretations and commentaries on this book. But Brother Ali, as the leader of Iran says, Ayatollah Khamenei, Nahjul Balagha is a help book for knowing more the religion of Islam. How we can know Islam more, or the true Islam more, through the book Nahjul Balagha?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. Thank you very much for this beautiful and important question, because it could be a good question even for those who are living in the West or those who are not very familiar or acquainted with Islamic knowledges and sciences, even abroad. And I mean, abroad, I mean outside of the Islamic countries, and namely our country, Iran. For a person, definitely for a researcher, to know about Islam, I think the best thing is to refer to the real and basic sources of that issue of research. Brother, we cannot judge Islam by what has been said or has been written by others about Islam, or those who claim to be Orientalist or others cannot be a reliable search or reliable source for us. It is famous to be said that it is good to drink water from the headwaters.
That's right.
That is
from the fountain.
From the fountain.
That's right.
So a person who wants to have a good water, a very purified and beautiful water, he needs to go to the fountain or the headwater of the to take from the real and genuine source.
The pure water.
If a person wants to know about Islam, so what is the best source to know about it? Definitely the first and the foremost source is Al-Quran, and this is true. But the second, if I have not got enough knowledge, enough ma'rifa, enough ilm about what Islam is, so what is the second? Which book should I read? There are different variety of books written about Islam with different intentions, but those who are real researchers, I want to tell them, if they are familiar with the art of research, as a researcher, as a scholar, as a person who wants to delve into a scientific question and issue, it requires to refer to Quran and Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of Eloquence.
That's right.
Because when Quran has been revealed to the Holy Prophet, it was supposed to be interpreted by him and his household. Mm-hmm. And actually, Nahjul Balagha is a sequence or following book of Al-Quran. And also, in some sort of way, we can say that even it is a good commentary of Al-Quran. And it the importance of it is to the importance, actually equals the importance of Al-Quran, because this is what the Holy Prophet himself told us when he talks about thaqalain, or two great heavy things, and he says, "Inni tarakum fikum thaqalain kitabullah wa atrati." I leave among you two important, heavy, precious things. One is Al-Quran, and the other is my Ahlul Bayt. It means that they are the interpreters of the Quran. So if you want to know about Islam, read the Nahjul Balagha. Okay. If you want to know about Islam, first read Quran, then read Nahjul Balagha. And Nahjul Balagha has been written or said, actually, as a collection of sayings and wisdoms and sermons and was sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And he is the first person who came to accept Islam among the Muslims. He was the first person who accepted and embraced Islam at the dawn of Islam. And then he became the leader of this religion at the dawn of Islam, right after the Holy Prophet. So whatever comes to us is from this person.
Okay, thank you much, Brother Ali. So it shows that the sayings in the Nahjul Balagha are really practical ones.
Very true.
That's right, and comes from the practice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. I could remember there was one professor of mathematics in one of the foreign universities. He was invited to the city of Qom. I was his interpreter, the translator. Mm-hmm. His name was Dr. Munir Fasher. He said that once I was looking for a book in my library, and all of a sudden, by accident, I came to a book known as Nahjul Balagha. So I picked it. When I opened it, the first sentence and the phrases that I wrote, I said, who is this man? And who was this man who wrote this? This is really close to the texture of the Holy Quran. I've never seen something like that before. And he said that for me as a Christian, it was really a shock that how the wording of Imam Ali alayhi salam could be similar to the Holy Quran in terms of the eloquence and the fasaha and the balagha. That's right. Okay, Brother Sohail, let's get to
related to what you said, Shakib Arsalan.
Shakib Arsalan, okay.
Egyptian scholar and belletrist, when he was appointed to be given, I think, a prize for his literary works, the presenter of that conference or that meeting said that we can see only two important and great literary works in the history. One is for Shakib Arsalan and the other is for Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. He got angry and stood up and said, are you comparing me to Ali alayhi salam, Ali ibn Abi Talib? Who am I to be compared to Ali in my literature? Though my nasr or my writings in comparison to Ali is nothing.
Okay.
This is just to complement what you have said.
That's right. And we should take care that Ali was not a belletrist. He was an imam, okay? He was a successor to Prophet Muhammad. His verse has divine rootings, and we can say roots. The case, sometimes what is misunderstood in the world of Islam among the blatterists and the men of literature is that they are comparing the text of the Holy Quran, Saifat al-Sajjadi and Nahjul Balagha, to a mere text of adabiyat or literature. But that was not literature, okay? That was a part of the literature of Islam. But the case is that the text and the context of this book is very much different from the stories, the, we can say, novels, short novels or something like that, or the poetry.
That's very important point, actually.
Yes. Brother Sohail, what's your take on that?
Yes, brother, that's a very good point that you mentioned about Imam Ali alayhi salam being leader and not just belletrist. Oftentimes, like, you know, people tend to limit certain things to a certain area. Like, for example, Nahjul Balagha, if you look at that book from the literature point of view, then it's limiting to it. But very rightly, Rehber mentions in one of his speeches that it's not a work of a wise man, for example, who is, you know, out of his rationality and, you know, the high level of cognition, he's writing something or he is mentioning which is not connected with the reality. Mm-hmm. Or it's not the work of a spiritual man or Arif, for example. The wayfarer, you would say.
That's right.
It's not the work of that spiritual being who is projecting his inner thoughts and his inner feelings into some sermons and, you know, speeches.
That's right.
It's not that. It's actually connected and very well touched with the reality, because he was the leader at the time, and he touched upon all the dimensions of humanities. He touched upon various aspects that human life faces. Okay. There is about war in Najul Balagha. There is about peace in Najul Balagha. Mm-hmm. There is about politics. There is about economy. There is about taqwa. There is about worshipping God. So there is about tawhid. There is about belief system.
That's right.
So it's a complete code of conduct. If you look at the book in that particular angle, then how Reber mentions is, when you read Nahjul Balagha and when you comprehend that, in a process you get to know Imam Ali alayhi salam and you get to know Islam.
That's all right.
Both at the same time, because, you know, it's a complete Islam Shanasi.
Yes. Islamic studies.
Yeah.
Islamology.
Right. And then you know about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam as well, because Imam Ali alayhi salam lived his life based on Quran and Najul Balagha himself.
This is very important, the important point that Brother Sohail says. You know, when we get to the interpretation of the religion of Islam and the character of the Prophet Muhammad and Holy Quran, there are so many different sayings regarding this. And every person from his own aspect and angle has talked about Prophet Muhammad and the reality of Islam. But when you get to the text of Nahjul Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the very personality of his sayings, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source now, because Ali was the first Muslim. He was among the most important authentic Sahaba of Prophet Muhammad. He was the successor of Prophet Muhammad. So many divine secrets have been blown into his spirit by Prophet Muhammad. So when you want to know Islam and the true Islam, I think some people maybe condemn us of fanaticism, that you are a fanatic and we can say fan of the religion of Islam because of Muhammad and because of the very nature of Islam. But when you get to Nahjul Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you can find how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, and then the Prophet of Allah, that is Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world. You know, when we want to refer into the interpretation of Islam, we start from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, in one of the tradition, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that know the truth and you will know the people of truth.
Mm-hmm. People
so
of truth,
so
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth,
mm-hmm.
and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities. So you don't learn the things through the personality, but you know the personality through the, you know, the substance.
That's
and
right.
Very rightly mentioned, in one of the tradition we also see that, and again I'm paraphrasing, where our Holy Infallible Alayhi Wasallam says, if you present our sayings and our teachings to people as they are, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when you present the content to the world, and they'll definitely, you know, Reber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are, those who are criticizing Islam, or those who have some issue, and then they are pinpointing each and everything about Islam.
That's all right.
Before doing that, I would like to tell them, and he clearly mentioned that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the Reformation, quote unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them. And, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Nahjul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Sohail and Brother Ali Alavian, for
your
presence in the program. Viewpoints, which was on the topic in Nahjul Balagha, as discussed by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners, visit our website at parstudio.com/Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Thank you.
أقبل تعال فالشوق طال والقلب سما نحو السماء مترنما لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Commissioners have found that both U.S. laws and police practices, as documented in the 44 cases heard by the commissioners and national data, do not comply with the international standards on the use of force, says Marjorie Kahn-Ryder in an article titled, Commission Finds Anti-Black Police Violence in U.S. Constitutes Crimes Against Humanity. Stay tuned for the details, please. On April 27th, the International Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States of America issued its long-awaited report on the U.S.'s police-perpetrated racist violence. The commissioners concluded that the systematic police killings of black people in the U.S. constitutes a prima facie case of crimes against humanity, and they asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to initiate an investigation of responsible police officials. These crimes against humanity under the ICC's Rome Statute include murder, severe deprivation of physical liberty, torture, persecution of people of African descent, and inhumane acts causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health. All of the crimes occurred in the context of a widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population of black people in the United States, as documented by the findings of fact in a 188-page report. The 12 commissioners are eminent experts and jurists from Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the Caribbean. After 18 days of hearings and extensive research, the commissioner found that both U.S. law and police practices do not comply with international law. Testimony of family members, attorneys, activists, and experts about police killings of 43 black people and the paralyzing of another was presented to the commissioners. All of the victims were unarmed or were not threatening the officers or others. Philonois Floyd, brother of George Floyd, testified before the commissioners. At a press conference announcing the release of the report, he said, "I want to thank the commissioner for recognizing my humanity as a good black man in America and for recognizing my brother George's humanity and the humanity of other families across this nation and bringing to light and acknowledging the United States government is perpetrating crimes against humanity against black people in the United States. This finding of crimes against humanity was not given lightly. We included it with a very clear mind," Commissioner Hina Jilani from Pakistan told The Guardian. "We examined all the facts and concluded that there are situations in the U.S. that beg the urgent scrutiny of the ICC." The commissioners made the following findings of fact. Pretextual traffic stops are a common precursor to police killings and uses of excessive force against people of African descent. Tavis Crane was killed by police after his young daughter threw a piece of candy out of the window. Race-based street stops, known as a stop and frisk, often trigger the use of deadly force by police. Eric Garner was suspected of selling individual untaxed cigarettes. George Floyd was suspected of using a counterfeit $20 bill. Fourth Amendment violations invariably lead to the use of excessive force and police killings of black people. Breonna Taylor was killed following the execution of a no-knock warrant after a judge had replaced it with a knock warrant. Police routinely use excessive and lethal restraints against black people. They include tasers, chokeholds, compression, asphyxia, rough strikes, and the use of vehicles as deadly weapons. George Floyd died from asphyxia. Freddie Gray was taken on a 45-minute rough ride, resulting in his death. Lethal police violence against black people is exacerbated by officers' failure to provide medical attention. For example, Andrew Kurtz was kept in the back of a squad car for 17 minutes as he begged for help, repeating, "I can't breathe." He died of a heart attack in the car. Lethal police violence against black people experiencing a mental health crisis is systematic. After Daniel Pruitt's family called police to provide mental health assistance, he was walking naked in the street. The officers put a spit hood over his head after he began spitting. They held him face down on the pavement for 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and he stopped breathing. Systematic racist police violence kills and traumatizes black children and youth. 12-year-old Tammy Rice was shot to death by police as he played in a park with a toy gun. The young children of Jacob Blake witnessed their father being shot and paralyzed by police. And racist police violence traumatizes and devastates families and communities across the U.S. Manuel Elijah Ellis was hit, punched, choked, and tasered to death by American police. Black immigrants are particularly vulnerable to systematic racist police violence and police killings. Madam Jean, born in St. Lucia, was eating ice cream in his apartment when an officer walked in, mistakenly thinking it was hers, and shot him dead. What was she defending? Allison Jean, Madam Jean's mother, asked, as the only weapon he held was the color of his skin. Legal actors are complicit in police violence and killings of black people through qualified immunity and systematic impunity of officers. Police officers in the United States enjoy impunity for their racist violence. They're rarely held accountable for killing black people, and qualified immunity protects them against liability for violation of constitutional rights. Alarming pattern of destruction and manipulation of evidence corrupts and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors have a conflict of interest, and medical examiners often do the bidding of police. After Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, as Brown raised his hands and said, "Don't shoot," the officer backed his own gun and washed Brown's blood off his hands. After police killed Henry Glover, the officers burned the car with his body in it. Prosecutional misconduct and grand jury abuse. The offending officers testified at the grand juries in the killings of both Michael Brown and Tammy Rice, and in neither case was the officer cross-examined. There were no incitements of officers in either case. Systematic impunity and lack of oversight by police. Internal affairs investigations invariably exonerate officers. Police can't be trusted to police themselves. The blue wall of silence keeps officers from reporting misconduct by fellow officers. Police unions facilitate impunity of officers. The police union got the body camera footage a few days after the killing of Daniel Prude, but it took the Prude family 6 months to get it, and only after they filed several lawsuits and qualified immunity. A recent U.S. District Court judge wrote, "Judges have invented a legal doctrine to protect law enforcement officers from having to face any consequences for wrongdoing." The doctrine is called qualified immunity. In real life, it operates like absolute immunity. In case after case heard by the commissioners, victims' families face extraordinary obstacles to holding officers accountable for the killing of their family members. The commissioners found that systematic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America has resulted in a pattern of gross and reliably attested violations of human rights and fundamental freedoms. These include violations of the right to life, the right to liberty and security, the right to mental health, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, and the right to be free from torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatments, including by the use of tasers, chokeholds, and compression asphyxia. The U.S. torture statute only punishes torture committed abroad. The commissioners also found violations of the right to be free from discrimination based on race, gender, disability, or status as a child. The stop and frisk doctrine is an invitation for racial profiling, and the Supreme Court allows pretextual stops for traffic violations even when the officer is motivated by racism in violation of international law. In addition, the commissioners found violations of the right to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence, which constitute extrajudicial killings, as well as the right to be treated with humanity and respect. The commissioners found violations of the duty to provide medical care to detained persons, to ensure investigations of extrajudicial killings that are independent, competent, thorough, and effective, and to prosecute suspects and punish perpetrators to ensure they are held accountable. The commissioners found that both U.S. laws and police practices, as documented in the 44 cases heard by the commissioners and national data, do not comply with the international standards on the use of force.
We are with you. What about you?